Avishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem, Hebron, the land of Israel, to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom, and welcome to beautiful Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov in the heart of Jerusalem. And you know what time it is? It's time for the first part of our show today, and that is Spiritual Cafe with Rabbi Mike Foyer. Shalom, Rabbi Mike!
Hi, Yishai. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you, and I am just so excited because so many favorite things are happening. It's like a kid. I know that there's going to be treats coming right now, and one of the treats is one of my favorite Torah portions, and another treat is one of my favorite days of the Jewish calendar, Lag BaOmer, one of my favorite days. I'm very, very excited for it, and I am so excited to be going tonight, Bezrat Hashem, with me and my closest 700,000 people up to Meron, to Lag BaOmer, to celebrate the revival of the mystical Torah, the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel in one big, giant dance, klezmer, and barbecue fest, and ultra-Orthodox fest. So I'm very excited about that, Rabbi Mike. And secondly, I'm also very excited for one of my favorite Torah portions, which is the penultimate climactic Torah portion of the book of Leviticus. The book of Leviticus, the book of really Jewish law and societal law. And it culminates with a set of promises that starts with, if you follow my decrees. It's like in Judaism, it's one of these things. It says bechukotai. You just know bechukotai. In bechukotai telechu. If you go in my decrees, great things are going to happen. And this Torah portion also lays the proverbial smackdown when it lets us know that if we're bad, we're going to get bad, which is also a kind of blessing, right? When you're good, you're going to get good. When you're bad, you're going to get bad. God is going to interact with you. He's going to dance with you. He's gonna love you when you love him and you respect him. He's gonna give you a loving slap if you go astray. And these first three words, im bechukotai telechu, I go down to my favorite commentator, the Baal HaTurim, and he says like this. Look at this. Look at this. The Baal HaTurim, so classic. He says, im bechukotai telechu, rashei tevot avot. The first three letters of these three words, im bechukotai telechu, if you go in my pathways, stand for the forefathers. And he says, Shetelchu b'darkei avot, go in the way of the forefathers. Go in the way of the forefathers. That's such a recurring theme. And Rabbi Mike, I wanted to kind of ask you, you know, like, why not just give me a sweet Torah portion full of sweetness? Why make it the moznaim? How do we say that? The scales? The
scales of judgment.
Scales of judgment, scales of good and bad. Like, it's like there's like the good. And then it's all like, you're just like reading it, you're like smiles. And then he's like, but, dun, 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 if you, then this will happen. And a darkness ensues. And what people don't know is that the Bible has a dark side, shall we say. Is that an unfair statement?
I don't know if I would call it the dark side. To me, this is the reality of the world. I mean, I think that...
Karma? Is that what you mean?
No, that if you touch the hot stove, you get burned. If you play in the street, you're going to get hit by a car.
Right.
On some level, when people look at this Torah portion as the portion of divine reward and punishment, as it's often seen, and indeed, I think on the surface it's presented, I take exception in it. Because I think in the end of the day, it's not about reward and punishment. It's about God saying, listen, I've given you the guide to the world.
There's a system here.
There is a system. It's kind of like, you know, if I give you the user's manual to your oven, and it says, by the way, the door is hot when cooking, and you don't bother to read the manual, and you know, cook up some, I don't know, lasagna in your oven, you touch the door, and it burns you, and you start saying, why have I been punished for touching the oven? You haven't been punished. You touched a hot oven. The fact that you didn't know is on you, and that's why, actually, Rashi, when he says, what does im bechukotai telecho mean? It doesn't mean actually to go in my statutes, because the next half of the phrase is vet mitzvotai tishmu, and you should keep my commandments. So why would it double itself? He says, no, the first part is that you walk in Torah, that you actually do the labor that's involved in learning in order to know how the world works, because it's not obvious. It's not obvious in how the world works. I hear the idea of this being the dark side in the sense that nobody likes it when bad things happen. And nobody likes punishment. Nobody likes consequence.
Well, it also kind of highlights a certain characteristic in the Jewish people, which maybe here on to in the Bible you didn't know yet. You'll get to know it in the next book, and that is that there's an aspect of the Jewish people which is wayward. Maybe you met it a little bit in the book of of Exodus. We met it a few times. But there's like another side to the Jewish interaction with God, and that is, he says, and he'll say it a few times, like, you guys also have some bad traits, and those bad traits are gonna be punished. Meaning to say, if you walk in my statutes and learn deeply the Torah, or also I think it could also mean not just follow my specific decrees, but also understand the general meaning of it and behave properly.
And let the Torah shape who you are, as opposed to looking at it as a book of rules.
Right, so that's one. But then if you go with me, Bekeri, if you go with me how do we translate that?
Well, I have a lot to say about that. Do you want to go there now, or do you want to finish your thought?
Well, what's your one-word translation?
The one-word translation is happenstance.
Right. If you go with me, happenstance, or if you go with John Kerry,
right.
those are the both true things. Like, if you go with John Kerry, things are going to go real bad for you. If you go with me with happenstance, things are going to go bad for you. But it also belies that the Jewish people may yet again, God forbid, go with God in happenstance.
Well, listen, you said, you know, there's a wayward side to the Jewish people, and I think there's just a wayward side to humanity. You know, as we say, the Jews are just like everybody else, only more so, right? In that sense, what really differentiates us is that we're still telling our story. And that's where we see the great chesed, the great loving kindness, in this model of punishment or consequences, I'd rather have it, right? In the fact that pain is one of the great gifts that we receive in life. Which can be a little bit odd for people, especially those of us from a Western culture, which has essentially founded its modern vision on avoidance of any pain and difficulty.
Right.
But the reality is if you can't feel pain, then you're either dead or in great danger. Because, you know, there is a disease where people can't feel pain. Yeah. Right? And imagine if you cut the back of your leg open and you were just bleeding out into your shoe and you had no idea. Right? So here, as we've spoken about before, I believe, on the show, like, this is another indication that God sends us these punishments, that you burn yourself when you touch the stove in order to avoid destruction, in order to learn from your actions. Right? And that's why that notion of carry, which I translated as happenstance, is so profound. I mean, here it is. You get, I think, one of the most important theological assertions about how the universe works in this parsha. Right? And what is it? There's this repeated line, right? And if you still don't listen to me, and the curse is very long, and I always find it very heavy and shul when we read it, there's this repeated line, and if you still don't get it, and if you still insist, no, all those terrible things happen because of economic social conditions, all those, you know, the people hate us because, you know, the reality is we were an indigestible element in their society, et cetera, things as a historian, I'm quite aware of these explanations. And if you still don't get it, says God, finally, you know what the ultimate punishment is? Then you know what? I'll go with you. I'll go with you on that. And the world will indeed respond as if it were just coincidence, as if it just happenstance. And a world of coincidence is a world that lacks meaning. And it's a world in which I can't learn, and therefore I can't grow, and I can't teach my children and build a better place. I'm simply subject to the vagaries of existence. And that's the ultimate punishment.
And it's like meaninglessness.
Yes.
You just kind of sway back and forth.
Yes, there is no story which holds it all together.
There was a rabbi, by the way, who didn't. Let me step back. There is a Jewish tradition that when we read the two chapters in the Bible that are filled with the curses, that we read it quietly.
And quickly.
And quickly, in a kind of a hushed tone, in order to get through it. And Sephardi Jews, every day when they read the Kriya Shema, in the kind of, also there's a little bit of a curse, a warning, also read that kind of silently to themselves as opposed to the rest of the Kriya Shema, which they read out loud. There was a rabbi who went through the Holocaust who, when his gabbai, his sexton in shul, began, his the Torah reader began to, the laner actually, began to read that this Torah portion quietly, he said to him, no, read it out loud, because we went through it. We're on the other side of it. Like, we went through the worst.
You know who it was? It was the Sanzer.
The Sanzer.
And he moved from New York with his entire community here to Eretz Yisrael almost immediately after that. Rav Riskin tells a story in his book, because he was actually there to witness the entire exchange.
And
they came here.
Wow.
Because his natural response to the most obvious, if less than pleasant, indication that the Torah is indeed telling us the truth of our story was, well, it also says that this is where we belong. So it's time to pick up and leave. And right. He indeed did.
Well, it would be awesome if, as people always say to me, from your mouth to God's ears. I always say, how about from his mouth to our ears? Okay, wouldn't that make a lot more sense? Let's just read very quickly through the blessings. I want everybody to get a little bit of a sense of it. And we're in the book of Leviticus, chapter 26. For some reason, the Bishop of Canterbury included the three verses that we don't actually include into chapter 26. Why did he break up the chapter like that? Silly bishop. Anyway, we read from chapter 26, verse 3. If you follow my decrees and observe my commandments, and you will perform them, then I will provide your rains in their time, and the land will give its produce, and the trees of the field will give its fruit. Meaning to say, nature will just work properly. Think, like, I've given you the miracle. The miracle is nature, but it'll work. It'll work well. Your threshing will last until the vintage, and the vintage will last until the sowing. You will eat your bread to satiety, and you will dwell securely in your land. What is this really? What are these phrases? They're really phrases of, it's all good, right? Everything is working out just right. It's almost like I don't need to do an extra thing. I'm not going to like make things stand on their head. I don't need to. I've given you the greatest miracle, which is the land of Israel and the nature of it. It is itself the Garden of Eden. It'll just work, right?
And I think it also, you said Garden of Eden. I think you put your finger directly on it there, because it also highlights that the source of the world's problems are not material. Because what God is basically saying, as you said, is that if you do what's right, then the world will keep working how I said it would work, which implies that the reason that things aren't going well is because we refuse to work with it. You know, I have a master's degree in international development. My first one was in geology, and I spent a number of years studying the challenges that the world faces as a global situation. I walk away with one primary lesson, that the world's problems are not technical. There's enough resource to give clean water, clothing, food, education to the whole world. The world's problems are moral. We lack the will to drive ourselves to actually realize human potential. And this is exactly what this parsha is about. If you read the Torah and you are refuse to be an animal and choose to be a human being and build a society that can be a vessel for my presence, then you'll live in Garden Eden, because that's where you were to begin with. And it's only your refusal to do so that leaves the world a mess.
So it's the system is ready for us. Just don't refuse him. And he says, I will provide peace in the land, and you will lie down with none to frighten you. Right? Now there's going to be, by the way, the verse before it said, and you will dwell securely in your land. V'yashavtem levetach b'artzachem, you will sit securely in your land. I read this last Shabbat in the Nitzivot Shalom. He said, you will dwell in your land due, not insecurity, but due to your faith, due to your bitachon, because of your unwavering faith. That is what's going to give you a secure dwelling in the land. Not that you will dwell in the land security, but through your sense of security, your faith in God, you will dwell in peace in the land. V'natati shalom ba'aretz, I'll give peace in the land. You will lie down with none to frighten you. I will cause the wildness of beasts to cease from your land. I think there's a hint there. And a sword will not cross your land. All right? It's not going to pass through your land. The sword will not, there won't be war.
Well, it's because we were also the great highway through which the empires in the ancient world passed to make war. And, you know, Ada Yom Hazeh, to this very day, we stand on the edge between the West and, you know, the rising power of Iran. You know, think about it. We live in a swirling mass of war all around us. Thank God for the security that we have.
I just came up with a parable. We're the eye of the storm.
We are the eye of the storm, which is, by the way, why we get so much press coverage. As I've heard,
is that why?
I've heard it from my brother. He should be healthy and well. Writes in the New York Times. So I've always had a certain relationship with some of the Times reporters that come here. And the unspoken or somewhat spoken truth is, this is a great place to cover a conflict,
right?
Because you can stay in a comfortable hotel.
Right.
Where your credit cards work, your cell phone is serviced, life is easy, and in 15-20 minutes, you can be in the heart of it all.
Right, that's on the reporter side, but the same thing is also true of all these NGOs and these like peace workers that want to go into a conflict zone. They want to go into a conflict zone at the daytime, nighttime, you know, party in Tel Aviv.
So, but my point is that I really feel that our destiny, that we are standing on the edge of real potential, is that we need to, sometime, let it be soon, actually actualize this whole image. which is that when we have the bitachon in Hashem to actually be secure in our land, that will be the time then to assert the fact that there doesn't need to be war passing through our region any longer, right? And just like America did the Marshall Plan after World War II and actually reorganized the world in a way which worked, right? So too, I believe that's the destiny of our future here, that the entire region is going to need to be reorganized.
It certainly will, and it's getting ready for that. It's the movers are in town. The movers are at the house. They are
all the work of the last 100 years has been chucked in the last 10. So there's a clean slate arising.
There's a clean slate. Ancient cities are being leveled, like Aleppo. Ancient societies are being broken. In fact, if you look at the Middle East right now, I really think that the ancient real countries are the only ones standing.
Yes.
Egypt, Israel, Iran, maybe Turkey. Basically, that's what's left standing. The rest are on shaky foundations.
That's right.
Maybe the Arab kingdom of Saudi Arabia is kind of, I don't know. The bottom line is that there's no more of these. There's no Iraq. Jordan is next. Lebanon is going to be gone. Syria is going to be gone.
It's because there was a mistaken association between nationhood and nation state. I mean, the nation state is a sociopolitical entity which organizes power in order to maintain order. Good, bad, or otherwise, it doesn't really matter. And it can then be embodied by, like ourselves, by a nation, a real nation, in which case the two can be very powerful. But when it's basically empty of nationhood and is just simply a nation state, so then it's ripe for totalitarianism and empty propaganda, which is what we've seen fall all around us.
It's very hard to coalesce completely different peoples. Nationalism really works nicely when you have a nation.
It's probably just a bad idea, meaning there are other means of organizing humanity. The nation state is not an intrinsic value. It's an instrumental one.
Well, that's going to be very interesting to see what comes next. The next verses, verse 7 says, "You will pursue your enemies," which is already a great chiddush, a great innovation. It's so wonderful just to pursue your enemies and not to let them actually thrive in your country and to let them teach the most horrendous neo-Nazism right, you know, in your nation's capital, maybe even the holiest spot to your nation, to blare out the worst kind of anti-Semitism. No, the promise will be, as we said, everything's natural. You'll be natural. You will pursue your enemies. And this is the good news. They will fall before you by the sword. 5 of you will pursue 100, and 100 of you will pursue a myriad, and your enemies will fall before you by the sword, meaning to say the Six-Day War.
I mean, just the image that comes to my mind is, you know, the story of Rav Gorin single-handedly capturing Hebron. You must, since you're there. But just to share with our listeners, after the conquest of Yerushalayim and the astounding cracking open of the world that it was, right? They say that Rav Gorin was so inflamed with the arrival of the divine presence that he grabbed a driver and a shofar and began to just race toward Hebron, blowing the shofar and literally ahead of the army. And people fled before him, right? In the same way that the Torah just described they would.
At that moment, Rav Gorin, in general, during the Six-Day War, was, I think, an angelic figure, a messianic figure, a some kind of cross between an Elijah the prophet, a Kohen Mashuach Milchama, like a priest of war. He was, and by his own accounting, he said, he just talks about kind of being possessed.
Mm-hmm.
He was the right man for the right time. And he says that when he came to the old city, he didn't feel like his feet were touching the ground. And you could see it in the pictures. There was something about him at the time which was like, it was otherworldly. It was certainly otherworldly, and it was certainly biblical otherworldly. Like it wasn't like otherworldly, like
aliens.
Call home, right? It was more like phone home. It was much more like, wait a minute, I've seen this film. I've seen this. I haven't seen it in a long time, but in my dream of dreams.
Oh, we could use a little bit of that otherworldly energy.
Yeah. Let's keep going. I will turn my attention towards you. I like that a lot. I'll give you my attention.
That's all we want.
Yeah, I just want some attention, God. Ufaniti elechem. Literally, I will turn to you. I will turn my attention to you. God, just give us your attention. Come on. I will make you fruitful and increase you, and I will establish my covenant with you. Right? Ufaniti elechem, vefreti etchem, verbeti etchem, vakimoti et briti etchem. Wow. You will eat very old grain and remove the old to make way for the new. I will place my tabernacle among you, and my spirit will not reject you. which is kind of what the tabernacle, like God getting too close to you is a little bit dangerous. He can't usually kind of walk around with us too much. When he has this tabernacle amongst us, he kind of can stand us a little bit better. Somehow we behave in such a way that we're able to be a vessel that he can hang out in and not be, you know, not be like, and there are words like this, like grossed out by us, like look tigael nafshi. I won't like be like, I won't have to like reject you.
And again, it's a center point for society, because I think it's important to remember that all these blessings and curses are in the language of the Rabbim. It's right. It's speaking to the people as a whole. The Torah itself only tangentially relates to the individual and their relationship with God. Right. The blessings and curses are national blessings and curses, which is why the land is their vessel. Right. And so the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and then ultimately the temple become that center point around which to build a society, which as a whole in its righteousness and in its devotion is a fit vessel for the presence of God.
We will be fit. And then my spirit will not reject you. I will walk among you. Maybe amongst you. I will walk amongst you. I will be God unto you. And you will be a people unto me. I am Hashem, your God, who took you out of the land of Egypt from being slaves. I broke the staves of your yoke, and I led you erect. I led you uprightly. V'olech otchem komemiyut. What a fascinating word, komemiyut. Komemiyut, a one-time appearing word in the whole Torah. And it's a strange word, but it basically means uprightly, standing up uprightly. I also like to darshan this word. Maybe another way it could be read is kumi mimavet, arise from death, arise from death, arise from death, arise from slavery, from Egypt. I took you out of Egypt. You were alive, but you were like dead. Kumi mimavet. I took you komemiyut, and you could read that in the letters there. I brought you up, and komemiyut as a word also is something, a kind of characteristic trait that God wants us to embody, to be upstanding. That's the word. It's upstanding. Upstanding citizens. Strong. Not just a kind of a broken. And it's ironic because there's also a halachic concept that you're not supposed to walk too erectly, too proudly. And yet as a Jew, you're supposed to reflect Malchus. You're supposed to reflect God's kingdom in this world. Zionism surely is also a return to a komemiyut-like existence amongst the nations, as opposed to being a kind of second class, you know, the Jew, the other. Here we are with our own country, and we have to be, without being haughty, stand uprightly.
And well, that's the challenge, is that what gives us that backbone, right? One of the real dangers that I see in Zionism is that what gives us that backbone is the desire to be a nation like others and to prove ourselves on the playing field, which the nations have proven themselves on historically, power, right? Control, right? Whereas what's meant to give us backbone, as the parsha began, is our adherence to God's will, which it comes through expression, through power, and through control. But I am very wary of the confusion of what we call ikar v'tafel, of the primary and the secondary, right? And that's why I think that stoopness, and it's a trope you can see through art and literature throughout history, the stoop neck Jew, which actually is embodied, as you said, in the halakha, that one is actually meant not to walk, you know, fully upright. It's a real challenge, because at the same time, why are you bowing? Are you bowing because you realize the presence of God and the smallness of what it is to be human? Or are you bowing because you're afraid of the people around you? If it's the latter, so that's why Zionism came along and says, no, we don't bow for that anymore. Right? At the same time, if what's keeping you upright is your feeling of kochiv otz miyadi, that it's the power of my hands that's done me this, well then, you're looking for trouble, right? In the end of the day, we should bow before God and walk erect because of his presence.
Well, like Mordechai, I think maybe Mordechai embodies that perfectly. He wouldn't bow, but it wasn't because he was so empowered.
No.
He was disempowered in a lot of ways, but he just wouldn't bow. You know, he only bows before the God Almighty.
I think that combination,
God Most High,
we can see always throughout Jewish history. And as you said, there's an idea of malchut, of kingship, and which is a fundamental problem you see throughout the Bible and later, is that what does it mean to be a Jewish king? Because all of Am Yisrael realizes that God is our king. So therefore, to be the Jewish king, you either are a usurper, you've taken something which is not yours, or you're nothing, because God is king, right? You're a placeholder. And that's that tremendous tension that our leadership faces, that either I can truly guide Am Yisrael to its destiny, and in order to do that, I have to realize that God is our real guide and that I am simply holding that space. But it can't be passive, Right? The tension there is enormous. I don't envy our leaders.
Speaking of our leaders, thank you so much to the folks who help us continue to make this show happen. And that is Jack, who sponsors the show. Also won the big flag from the top of the Mount of Olives. And Jack dedicates the show to his wife Lillian and his sister Sarah. Sarah, in her own right, has become a contributor to the show. Very much appreciated. Really makes all the difference in the world. It makes us able to keep going in so many ways, especially technical and other. So thank you very much to Jack and to Lillian, to Sarah. And they won one flag. We got a second flag. Our good friend Andy, down in Atlanta, comes here all the time. He won the second flag, and there's still a third flag yet to be won, a flag that has been flown in Jerusalem in the third coming of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, the era of the third temple. You can have that flag. Be part of the show. Be part of the broadcast, which is so important today because the lies are being broadcast. Instead, I also want to thank the good people at Chevron, who let me do the show. I'm the international spokesman there, and they understand the importance of broadcasting, especially the director general of the community, Uri Karzen, who leads the community through thick and thin, and really shows courage and the will to build that community as a light towards the connection of our forefathers who are buried in Hebron to the final kind of return of all the Jewish people to the land of Israel, all the children to the land of Israel, to follow in the footsteps of the forefathers. So thank you very much. And I also want to thank the good people at Capone Defense, who helped the Jewish people with a good spirit and a proper spirit and a correct spirit and a humility towards God, still know how to be physical fighters to make the Jewish people strong. I highly recommend you meet Avi. Go shooting with him. He will train you. He will train your fingers to be fingers of war and really in the service of God. Speaking of Chevron, I just wanted to mention that we do have a very fascinating verse here in the Torah portion here on Spiritual Cafe with Rabbi Mike Foyer, Yishai Fleischer. Sulam Yaakov is the Beit Midrash we're in, sulamyaakov.com for much more great content. And the verse is in chapter 26, verse 42, V'zacharti et briti Yaakov, v'af et briti Yitzchak, v'af et briti Avraham esko, v'aretz esko. I will remember my covenant with Jacob, and even my covenant with Isaac, and even my covenant with Abraham will I remember, and I will remember the land. So when one looks throughout the Bible, one gets this feeling that indeed the land is a creature, an entity, a character on its own. A little bit, you have to be a little bit of a Trekkie, and you get the sense that's like, you know, in Star Trek, there's always like creatures that are not in the regular form that you expect them to be in. They just like find a different form to exist in. They may, you know, they may take over the computer or they may do certain things, but there may very well be creatures that are sentient beings that are not necessarily persons like me and you. And it seems like the land is one of has characteristic traits. It is picky. It is choosy. It throws you out if it doesn't like you. Here it seems to be grouped in with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God surely remembers them, and He always remembers them. And there's also one more thing that He remembers: the land itself. It has some kind of memory in front of God. What is the memory of the land of Israel? I can understand if you said to me, all the Jewish people are gathered on the land of Israel, and therefore then you have how do you call it oftentimes, Rabbi Mike, you know, a societal or conglomerate, you know, a oneness that comes through a whole, you know, big family of people. But what is the land as a component, a specific land? Why not any other land? And what is this land? What is its memory in front of God?
So I think we can learn that really from the context, because Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the forefathers, when God recalls, so to speak, He reattaches, because of course there's no forgetting before God. So memory is not a recollection of something which had been forgotten, but rather a remembering, a reattachment to the present reality of their modes of relationship. That's what they brought into the world. They were the great lovers of God. They were the great servants of God. It was a new way in which creation could relate to Creator. In that sense, the land represents a deeper, more fundamental shift in the way which creation and Creator can relate. Because our sages teach us that when God chose to create physicality, and it's an incredibly wondrous thing that something which seems so coarse and so limited as the physical world, and so gritty as the earth, and by the way, so troubled and struggled over as Eretz Yisrael, could be the source of a unique relationship with the divine, with the infinite, and yet how could it be otherwise? Because embodiment is what allows for relationship. Right? You don't love your wife in the abstract. You don't love your children conceptually. Right? There's a physical being who stands before you. And then, of course, there's layers of emotion, layers of intellection. There's aspiration. There's conceptualization. All these things. But only on top of that. And the land represents that. That's why the sages say that God began to create the earth from here. And not just from here, but from actually the stone which underlies the Temple Mount. We should Bizochet should be free someday soon, right? That was where the opportunity for relationship with God began, because it's where embodiment began. And all these other layers of depth and emotion and meaning and conception are founded upon that fundamental relationship with God's desire that there be physical other.
And that's the place.
This is the place.
Right. Well, speaking of the place, I'm recording this show... it might be playing a little bit later, but this is the eve of Lag BaOmer. Tonight's a big night of bonfires here in the land of Israel. We want to warn you here, public service announcement, to be careful. First thing, certainly not to steal or to take any wood, which is a common mistake that happens amongst children, that they take wood that doesn't belong to them. We want to warn you against that. We also want to warn you to be careful with fires. They are literally dangerous and can not only hurt people, but also property. So please be careful with that. Fasten all seatbelts. And in general, you know, this is a holiday to celebrate and not to lose your head. So please be careful. On the other hand, about 700,000 Jews, maybe more, are heading out to Meron. Sephardic Jews, ultra-Orthodox Jews, especially the Hasidic branch, and a lot of regular folks in Israel head up to Meron, which is the burial place of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, to celebrate a holiday which is basically... It's a holiday that was resurrected by the Arizal, the great Kabbalist of the mid-16th century in Tzfat, who really brought back some of the lost, forgotten, or secretive Torah, the Kabbalah. And in that sense, I really do believe that this holiday is part of a triumvirate of holidays, and that is, one, Independence Day, where the land of Israel, the Jewish people, get physical. As we were just talking about physicality, physical independence in the land of Israel. Yom Yerushalayim, where there's like a connection between
heaven and earth.
Right, heaven and earth. And Lag BaOmer, which I think represents the Torah. It just represents the victory of Torah over the Romans. The Greco-Roman world always wanted to cut down on the Torah. We had to go into hiding during the time of the exile. Now, as we began to return, so too we began to experience the Torah in its third, fourth, and fifth dimensions, and so on, and it's incredible depth. What represents that is Lag BaOmer. It also represents not just Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, but also his teacher, the great, and maybe the greatest, Rabbi Akiva, who resurrected Torah after his students were destroyed, and who even Moses had a vision that Rabbi Akiva understood the Torah to a level that even Moses didn't understand. And so these great people are remembered tonight. And really, tonight we celebrate the inner Jewish the Jewish drive, which is the Torah, the revelation, as we started with this talk today, which is the guidebook to it all.
And the guidebook which allows us to release the light which exists even in the darkest places. Right? There's a reason that Rabbi Shimon's Torah came out into the world, as you said. He was hiding from Rome in the cave. I mean, what could be a darker period in Jewish history? Although, unfortunately, now we could probably think of one. But when a foreign people controlled our land, when our leaders were forbidden from teaching Torah to the point where they had to hide in literally physically dark spaces in order just to survive, and out of that cave burst a light which may have lay dormant, as you said, for almost 1,500 years, but in the end of the day is, in many ways, I agree with you 100%, illuminating the return to our land we see now, which is the one redeeming element I see in the bonfires, right? Why? Because it's a fascinating thing, and this is why I believe people like fire, is that you take a piece of wood and it appears to be dead, inert, but all you need to do is get over the hump, Right? You got to get over that activation energy. You just put a little bit in there and it bursts into life and you release light and heat and flame. You realize that that distinction between heaven and earth is actually not real. It's just a matter of consciousness and the effort you can put in. And so therefore, when we release all that energy and all that light and that fire, what we're really indicating is the truth is that it's all from God.
And there's a nuclear explosion that's happening here as the Jewish people are returning to the land of Israel. There's a tremendous light and heat and energy that's being released.
Let it light the world.
Let it light the world, and don't get a sunburn. Just you know, put on the SPF, but at the same time, don't be afraid to get out there and get into the sun. We are coming back home to the land of Israel. Magic is happening. Torah is being revealed. And we are also celebrating all the way up to Shavuot. We're counting up. Today's the 32nd. Tonight's going to be the 33rd, the Lag B'Omer. And we are hopefully coming to Shavuot, the day of receiving of the full Torah. Rabbi Mike, thank you so much for helping us receive the Torah today.
We should merit to receive it together.
Amen. You are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show. Would love to hear from you, so write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Land of Israel Network. It just rocks the world. It has a tremendous light that it wants to broadcast to the world. Land of Israel Network. Check us out. We have many more great shows. Write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Connect to me on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, LinkedIn, and whatever else. Not yet on Snapchat, whatever. But all of those is at Yishai Fleisher. And most importantly is to connect to the story of Israel, the light of Israel, and the God of Israel, because you're part of the story. And stay tuned. More great stuff is next. Next up, we're going to be speaking about the incredible political upheaval that has happened here, maybe for the good, in the last few weeks with our own political insider, Jeremy the Man Sultan. So stay tuned, stay strong, and we'll be right back. All right, folks, we're back here on the Yishai Fleisher Show. Switched buildings. Before we were in Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, and now we're at the World Mizrahi building, where lots of Torah and Zionism get spread out to the world, including Bnei Akiva Olami and Torah Mitzion Kolels, and a lot of good stuff happens in this building. And I'm here with our Knesset insider. KnessetJeremy.com is the website, KnessetJeremy.com, and Jeremy Sultan is our assistant in all things Knesset and Israeli politics. Thank you, Jeremy, for joining us today.
It's great to be with you.
It's great to have you back. And the reason I wanted to have you back on the show specifically now is because Israel has gone through some kind of amazing turmoil, kind of upheaval that I haven't seen the likes of in a while. And it was kind of fun to watch it if you weren't emotionally invested in it. Of course, we're all emotionally invested in it. Still, there was something amazing that happened. And basically, the way it looked from the outside is the following, that you had members of the chief of staff's office, the chief of staff and his deputy, saying all kinds of phrases that were just inappropriate. That was the first kind of inkling that we had that there was some kind of earthquake, political earthquake was happening. They had said things that seemed very political, very inappropriate in Israel. First, I'll never forget how Eisenkot, the chief of staff, who's, let's put it another way, the head of the army. It's weird that the head of the army has such a funny name, chief of staff. He's the number one general, the top general in the country. He says, that Jewish principle of arise, if somebody comes to kill you, arise earlier and kill them, that's not our principle. That's a very unsophisticated old principle. We have more modern, more interesting, more complex, and we are above that kind of biblical morality. We are much more nuanced morality. But the way he said it, he denigrated Judaism and also denigrated the first strike capability of Israel. And then he also made a phrase that said something like, well, you don't want to shoot a little girl that's coming at you with scissors by shooting a whole clip of bullets into her. And it was like almost like he was creating every single anti-Semitic meme for the anti-Semites, as though the anti-Semites would be like, look, your own chief of staff is saying you're shooting little girls coming at you with scissors with asymmetrical firepower. That was the first step. The second one was that we had, this one was totally egregious. The deputy chief of staff comes up there. He comes up to speak on Holocaust Remembrance Day. And on this day he says, well, I'm looking around and I see Israeli society and sometimes I see that I it looks to me like we're the Nazis. We're the new Nazis of today. Some elements of Israeli society remind me of the Nazis. And this was, not only was this fodder for the anti-Semites again, for the anti-Semitic media. Just yesterday, Jeremy, I did an interview, and the journalist, a European journalist, asked me, he's like, well, your own deputy chief of staff said, you know, you have Nazis in the country, so isn't that true? I mean, this is a very important person saying that. So provided that kind of language for the haters of Israel, and also broke the heart of so many Israelis talking on Holocaust Memorial Day, when 6 million died. It was too much to take, and then a political firestorm ensued, where the defense minister says, "Yeah, I think that generals in the army should be allowed to speak whatever they want. They should speak, you know, talk political talk, whatever, whenever they want." And this is in blatant contradiction to simple democratic principles that the army is a tool of the legislature, the tool of the people, and not a political entity unto itself. These are the three things that I saw from the outside, and then a rumbling ensued. What happened was is that Moshe Yaalon, who was the defense minister, was basically booted out of his position, and then he took that and he quit politics, ostensibly, at least for now. He left the Likud, left Netanyahu's side. You'll explain to me if I'm making any mistakes. And then he just left politics, which allowed another Knesset member to come in. And who came in but a very nationalist, well-known Temple Mount activist, Yehuda Glick, Rabbi Yehuda Glick. And at the same time, a whole other party joined the coalition. And instead of Moshe Yaalon, we had Avigdor Lieberman become the defense minister and bring in his whole Israel Beiteinu party into the coalition, broadening it out and making what ostensibly seems one of the most quote-unquote right-wing nationalist coalitions in Israel's history. All right, so that is the background on it. Jeremy, everybody was on edge, and what I didn't mention yet is that the whole time the negotiations weren't with Israel Beiteinu at all, they were with the Zionist Union, the some people call them post-Zionist Union, maybe, but certainly the what's considered the left here in Israel. They were the ones who were going to inherit that position. They were the ones that are going to join the coalition. That didn't happen, and the interplay throughout the story that was happening, kind of unfolding in the media and throughout the whole week, everybody was on the edge of their seats, and they thought we're going to a much broader national unity type of coalition. Instead, we went to a what is being termed a far-right government. All right, that was the outside take. Now, Jeremy Sultan, our Knesset insider, a little bit for that inside take.
Sure. I feel like you can do at least an entire course in a university just on what happened over the last week plus, but we'll try to go ahead and get it here as concise as possible and emphasize a few important points. Let's start a little bit before that. We had an election a little over a year ago. We got 67 seats for what's known as the right religious bloc, the nationalist camp, and the rest ended up going to what's considered the center Arab left bloc. Now, Netanyahu won what I call phase one of the process of choosing the prime minister by getting 30 seats. He was able to, in phase two, get the nomination of those 67 MKs from the president to be able to form a government. He was able to form a government, however, in phase three in the final Knesset vote with only 61 of them. Because of that, we've had a very narrow 61-59 coalition versus opposition ratio for the last year.
And that's because Yisrael Beiteinu stayed out of the coalition.
Correct. Yisrael Beiteinu, with their six seats, stayed outside of the coalition. So, you know, if we fast forward and we have Yisrael Beiteinu joining the coalition, that's not really a surprise. Again, this is part of this nationalist camp that was the winner of phase one, and the same nationalist camp that nominated Netanyahu to serve as prime minister in phase two, and only now, a year late, are they coming ahead and joining the actual coalition. But there's a lot of important things that happen in the middle. I'll go ahead and hit on a few of them. Netanyahu, for the last year, has kept the foreign ministry open. He said, I'll give it to anybody who will come, whether it is the Zionist Union's Isaac Herzog, whether it's Yesh Atid's Yair Lapid, or whether it is Avigdor Lieberman from the Yisrael Beiteinu party. You had a situation where suddenly, because of a reality that in the Zionist Union party, labor which leads the Zionist Union, were moving, inching towards a primary that Herzog was trying to delay at all costs. His thought process was, from the political side, if he entered the Netanyahu government, he would be able to push off that leadership election, which, should it happen today, he is expected to lose. Now, on the other hand, Netanyahu just wanted to expand his coalition, so he was happy to go ahead and bring in Herzog, despite the fact that he had an entire campaign based on it's me or them, basing his entire campaign not on his record of the previous three terms of being prime minister, rather saying, you either elect me or you're going to get Herzog and Livni as people in this leadership of the government. He turned around and said, look, Lieberman didn't come in, so I'm willing to sit with Herzog. Meanwhile, you had people in the settlement establishment that helped bridge the gaps between Lieberman and Netanyahu. Lieberman was offered the foreign ministry to start with, and he said no. He served as foreign minister in the second and third Netanyahu governments.
And that's not exactly a good position for him.
And you know what? He didn't really want to go back there. He wanted the defense ministry. He said that even back during the election campaign itself. Now, an opportunity happened, and he talked a little bit about it, where Yalon made himself politically expendable. Now, because he was now politically expendable, Netanyahu was willing to remove Yalon from the defense ministry, insert Lieberman, so he would be able to bring up his coalition from 61 to 67.
But he was willing to chuck a partner who had been at his side for a very long time in the defense ministry, right?
Yeah,
Yalon, Netanyahu, that was like a duo for a long time.
Yeah, Yalon is a very interesting person. He comes from the kibbutz movement. He comes from a leftist-type home. However, in the army, he was considered a hawk. He was actually fired by then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon for opposing the disengagement from Gaza. In fact, if you look at some of his recent statements over the last few years as defense minister, calling Kerry messianic and having other choice words for other people, this is a person who also says that he doesn't really see a future of a Palestinian state being created. This is a person, if you've ever heard him, and he's a brilliant analyst, not as good of an executive, but a brilliant analyst in terms of what we face on all of our borders. And his view of the Middle East from a macro perspective, he's a very big pessimist. He definitely exhibits a lot of interesting views when it comes to that. However, Yalon, for whatever reason, decided recently to try to become more and more moderate. The first speech that I noticed that was a bit more moderate was actually last June in the Herzliya conference, where he started breaking from a lot of his new positions, and that was happening about a month after he was appointed defense minister for the second time. Now, you mentioned that Eisenkot is someone that he ended up backing
the chief of
up.
Staff.
Right, Eisenkot, who leads the army. It was also Yalon that pushed to have Eisenkot lead the army. It was also Yair Golan, the deputy chief of staff, who Yalon is grooming to one day replace Eisenkot. I don't know if that's going to happen now, but again, another Yalon person that he was able to go ahead and elevate to that position. Yalon has his own specific people. Again, as a former chief of staff himself, as a former major general himself, he has his friends.
He knows the system.
He knows the system. He's trying to promote the people that have his philosophy and ideology. And yes, that started to come at odds with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Some people say that it started with the situation of the soldier in Hebron. Other people say it was before. Other people say it was later. But the final straw, to me at least, was when, after they had agreed that they were going to bury the hatchet, that Netanyahu, he was just really surprised when Yalon said to senior army officials that they should continue to speak their mind even when it's against government policy, and that he will back them up for doing so. Now, in most democratic countries, if an army officer goes publicly against government policy, they're going to lose their job. That's not something that's usually accepted. The army is a separate entity. They're part of the executive branch. They get the orders from the defense ministry, from the security cabinet, and they're supposed to follow those orders. They're not supposed to be going out and expressing their political opinions. So Netanyahu said, I'm going to bring in Lieberman. This is going to help me with my coalition. And he also said, listen, Yalon, I don't want to lose him. I'll put him in that foreign ministry position.
Oh, okay, that's where you nodded that I made a mistake, right? He basically said to Yalon, okay, I want you out of defense, but you can go into foreign minister, which he would have been a fine foreign minister, maybe.
A lot of people said he would, and if
he's
really
a good
wanted,
speaker, he's a smart guy, like you said, he could have been very diplomatic.
If he wants to be prime minister, there's a rule, an unofficial rule, that besides Menachem Begin, who was the leader of opposition, didn't have a chance, and David Ben-Gurion, who was the first prime minister, anyone who's gotten to the position of prime minister had to go first through the finance, foreign, or defense ministries. And people who've been in two positions are usually very, very good candidates, and in most cases, a lot of them did end up filling two of those three positions before becoming prime minister. So Yalon, who does want to lead the country, it would have been a good idea for him politically, even though for his ego it was difficult to accept that. Now, he didn't
leave
Likud.
He could have been on the international stage.
He could have.
And he speaks English. He does a good
job.
And
he could have also said whatever he wanted against Lieberman as well, I would assume.
Right.
Since Yalon already proved that he could stay for nearly a year in power by expressing a lot of views that are against those of the prime minister. I'll just say one other quick thing on that. There are some cynical people that say there's a state comptroller report that's going to come out that's going to make Yalon look very bad, and the attempt to go towards a more moderate centrist position is meant to help him with academia circles, with the various cultural icons, of course, the media and other people in the opposition who will not go ahead and focus the entire blame on him, but rather perhaps on another individual.
So soften the blow.
Which is important, since Benny Gantz, who was then the chief of staff during the protection of
Protective Edge,
thanks for correcting me there, who's sort of giving a signal that he wants to go to the center-left camp, Yalon might be afraid that he'll be getting a brunt of that responsibility and blame, and this move sort of helps him. Now, Yalon didn't leave the Likud. He's still a card-carrying member of Likud. He said also when he resigned, he said, I'm not leaving politics. I'm taking a time out from politics. He said, I'm going to return, and when I return, I am going to return to the Hanaga Lumit. I'm going to return to lead
the nationalist camp.
Okay. Now, people want to interpret it one way or the other. I think if you look at his entire speech, in which he doesn't even criticize Yisrael Beiteinu once, not Avigdor Lieberman, not Bayit Yehudi, not Naftali Bennett once, he specifically is going at the Likud. It seems like he's trying to either go to that place where someone like Gideon Sar is, you know, a former number two and former loyalist of Benjamin Netanyahu, or perhaps create his own party. But regardless, Lieberman entering was a very interesting day. You know, it was Yud Aleph Iyar. It was my brother and sister's birthday. They're twins. And I didn't even have a chance to call them because, you know, we woke up thinking Herzog was going to be our foreign minister, and we went to sleep knowing that Lieberman was going to be our next defense minister. And the amount of crazy things that happened along the timeline of that day was ridiculous. Now, it turns out that Yisrael Beiteinu, that had six seats, right now looks like they only have five seats because Lieberman's own number two, Orly Levi Abuxis, told him, I'm not going to join the coalition with you. I'm going to remain in the opposition because she did not get a ministry portfolio.
Is that why she said her claim? That's not what I heard her claim was. Her claim was this was supposed to be a social justice, social welfare party. And now you're going to the defense ministry. You don't have defense ministry experience. And I don't want to be part of this charade.
Yes, I assure you, if she was given a ministry position instead of number three, Sofie Lanver, she would be in. I know there are a lot of people who are not as cynical as I am, but just as there were people who told me, no, Yalon is really resigning from the Knesset and the defense ministry because of real, you know, moral convictions, I'll remind all of them that they all sat with Lieberman when he was foreign minister,
right.
Both Orly Levi Abuxis, and that's not really a social ministry either, by the way.
Not at all.
And
in some ways, it's less of a social ministry than the defense ministry.
I'm just saying, Yalon would not have given that speech had Lieberman been re-entered to the security cabinet and given the foreign ministry.
Right.
Only because he had to leave his job and face demotion did he decide, I'm going to leave it all. The same thing with Orly Levy-Bukses. She feels, this is my third term.
So she's still a Knesset member?
She's still a
Knesset
member.
She's left the party?
She's not even yet officially left the party. It was actually very interesting watching Knesset this week, where she's sitting right next to Lieberman. The two of them are not even talking. When you officially leave a party, then you get a different spot.
Uh-huh. But she still is
officially a Knesset member.
Wow.
She needs to make a decision because a lot of what happens now will affect whether she's allowed to run in the next election or not.
Mm-hmm.
So she needs to figure out what it is that she wants to do. She can also decide to resign just like Yalon did, and then she will be able to run with whoever she wants in the next election anyways.
All right, so we're speaking with Jeremy Sultan, our Knesset insider, KnessetJeremy.com. We'll give you English language news about Israeli politics, and Jeremy's also famous for his translations and explanations of Israeli political polls, which give you a sense of trends. And speaking of trends, Jeremy, I thought to myself, maybe because of the way I think about things, but also my analysis of the country, I thought to myself that Yalon was making a mistake. I thought to myself, his advisors must be telling him that if he goes to the center-left, he'll get more, you know, votes. And I thought to myself, that's a mistake because that's not where the country's heading right now. What happened was is that there was a lot, as you said, we woke up in the morning thinking we may have Buzhi Herzog from the Zionist Union, which is a center-left party, be the next foreign minister, but we ended up with Avigdor Lieberman, and the Israeli center-left establishment, the media, the academia, and newspapers like the Times of Israel went absolutely ballistic, as though they were squirming and flipping out because it seemed suddenly that the Israeli government took a hard right turn. That's what that at least is the perception. In more sophisticated circles of people who know Lieberman and have had experience with him, there's not as much confidence that indeed there's going to be a solidification of the Jewish presence in Judea and Samaria, and that two-state is over, and other such nationalist ideas. They know that he's as a bus driver told me, a chameleon. His skin color can change. Still, though, no doubt about it, the flavor of Israel as a country took on a more nationalist, quote unquote, right wing hue. Is that right or not right? Was there a sociological shift in the country is the Knesset now representing any kind of sociological shift?
You know, yesterday, last night, I was by Ariel Dodd, who just had a book launch for his new book called "What You See From Here, You Don't See From There: How Right-Wing Prime Ministers Go Left." So, and it's very interesting. He talks about how Begin, Shamir, Netanyahu, Sharon, Olmert. He just goes through each case study, and on a very academic level, explains how they choose to be a lot more pragmatic and practical the minute they end up in that seat. Now, he said about Lieberman, because of course everyone asked, right? Because he did serve on the same list as Lieberman back in 2003. He said Lieberman used to be right-wing. Lieberman is no longer right-wing. That is why people make a mistake. Forget about what he used to say. Focus more on what he's saying now. And whenever there are things that are considered right-wing, it's just racist statements. It has nothing to do with actual policy.
His actual policies are
very, very moderate.
I just want to help everybody understand what we're talking about in Tachlis, because you're speaking in a kind of code that we all understand here in Israel. But basically, when we're saying, quote-unquote, right-wing, we're talking about the opposite of land for peace, the opposite of a two-state solution, and the opposite of negotiations. What that opposite is exactly is yet undefined, because two-state is a defined kind of outlook. How a not two-state solution looks like is a matter of discussion. But Ariel Dodd, and I've seen him define it literally, is somebody who's quote-unquote right-wing, who's nationalist, is against giving away land, So what you're saying is that Professor Dr. Ariel Dodd is saying that Lieberman is not against giving away land. He may very well be for that, and that's exactly what Lieberman actually says. He believes in giving away some land, exchange of lands. He believes that Jews should stay. He, by the way, is a settler himself, quote-unquote, and he lives in a settlement called Nokdim, right next to Tekoa, in the Tekoa Junction, Tekoa area. But he says that the settlements or the nascent communities in Judea and Samaria should be limited to blocks, to the settlement blocks, and the small ones, places like Hebron, see you later. We got to give that away.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Lieberman says, I'm willing to leave my own home for peace.
Right.
You know, the land swap idea that he believes in is something that's very close, by the way, to where John Kerry is. In fact, I saw Martin Indyk, who's the former, you know, negotiator, say that he says Lieberman is the one who is protecting Kerry's name when Yalon was off calling him names. So there are a lot of people who are very happy about this. In fact, Ahmed Tibi from the United Arab List, the joint list of the Arab parties,
a Knesset member who is basically devoted to the undermining of the state of Israel.
He's the former assistant and advisor of Yasser Arafat. And he said Lieberman is actually the only minister in the Netanyahu government now that's openly for a two-state solution.
Right.
So if TB is taking that
pro-Lieberman approach,
you know, that's a very interesting thing. But I want to say something for a minute about the media shift, because I think that's an important point to hone on down on. Like I said, 67 seats went to the same camp back in March,
right,
when we were at the days in May when it looked like we were going to have this government, after already having a situation where in April the president got the nomination from these 67. Nobody talked like this, meaning nothing has changed within the composition of the Knesset.
Right.
The only thing that's changing is the composition of the government.
And
the executive branch,
this was going to be the government anyway.
Yes.
This was almost a natural government. So there's no reason for the Times of Israel to flip out because this was what was voted in.
But it's beyond that. If you look at the Times of Israel and all these other places, they were saying a few months before the election, when Lieberman indicated he might go with Herzog and not nominate him for prime minister, suddenly they said, wait a minute, Lieberman is the hope. He's our new hope. He's going to help us. He's going to grab those right-wing votes, and he's going to bring them to a left-wing, anti-nationalist type government. And it wasn't just them saying it. Everyone was saying this. And a lot of people that I'm talking to, and it doesn't matter if they're left, right, nationalist, anti-nationalist, they're just so sick of the hypocrisy. They're seeing the same columnists, the same reporters, the same journalists who said a year and a half ago that Lieberman is a moderate, calm, voice of reason, and suddenly they're saying they don't want their children to grow up here. They think Lieberman is dangerous. They think Lieberman is crazy. They think that it's a delusional situation, that this is going to be the worst government ever, the most right-wing government ever, the most nationalist government ever, that we're going to start doing crazy things now in terms of policy. And it's just such hypocrisy, because even the people on the left, my friends, they tell me, they say, these guys were saying, you know, a year and a half ago that he was the Messiah.
Mm. Okay, let's wrap it up. I have one more real question for you, and that is, is it a done deal yet that Lieberman is the defense minister? There's still some it has not been signed. There are still partners that are within the coalition. The current coalition has to agree to kind of receive and accept these new coalition partners. So there's renegotiations, and most people foresee that it will succeed. Different partners want different things now. But let's say, given that Avigdor Lieberman is the new defense minister, that is a very serious position. For myself, working as the spokesman of the international spokesman for Hebron, this is a big question. The defense minister for us is also the governor of our region, and
he's your prime minister.
He's my prime minister, and he gets to sign off on many land deals that we've made, and yet we're not able to consummate them because the governor of Judea and Samaria, the military governor of Judea and Samaria, has not yet signed off on them. That's one. And two is the possibility of conflict and war. It's summer, you know, so why not? And many forces would love to see the end of Israel, or would like to at least reap the media benefits of fighting with Israel. With Avigdor Lieberman at the helm, who's kind of well known in Israel as a person not having a lot of military experience. What's the prospect? So that's the two questions.
Sure.
Is he going to sign off on blatantly right wing causes such as allowing Jews to consummate houses that they own in places like Hebron? And what will he do in a time of war?
Right. We're expecting to see a coalition agreement signed later today. The earliest that we would see a swearing in would be on Monday, assuming that the other coalition parties are happy. I'll just add in there that Israel Beitenu is going to be the smallest coalition party with 5 seats, and they're going to have the most senior portfolio, which is the defense minister, as you mentioned, the prime minister, the governor of Judea and Samaria. As for policy, there'll be a lot of commentary before he is sworn in towards what he will do. But let's look at what he said recently. About a month ago, he was asked, if he was defense minister, how he would act differently with Hamas. He said, Ismail Haniyeh, who is the leader of Hamas, will be given 48 hours, the minute that I am appointed defense minister, to return the 2 Israelis that are under captivity in Gaza, as well as the 2 bodies of soldiers that we lost during Operation Protective Edge. And if he does not meet that within those 48 hours, I will kill him. I will bomb his house. I will take him out. Now that's a very interesting thing. And there are plenty of other things that we can go ahead and talk about. But that's the type of quotes that we've seen. The question is, and that's the reason why I brought up the Ari Eldad story earlier, is Lieberman going to enter the defense minister, the defense ministry, the way that we saw a lot of these previous people, Menachem Begin, Ariel Sharon, Ehud Olmert, where he comes in as a right-wing person who promised a lot of things and then decides to take a more moderate stance the minute that he goes in? And really only the answer is time will tell. But indications are that if you want to listen to the Israeli media, we're going to have a war this summer. For sure. But if you want to listen to some of the other people, whether it is Ari Eldad, whether that is Ahmed Tibi, whether that is a Martin Indyk, you actually might be seeing one of the more moderate, well-received defense ministers that we've seen in recent years.
Will there be a war this summer? Is such indications? Can you give us any indication of that? Is there a trend towards that or not really?
You know, I saw Amos Yadlin, who was in the IDF for the longest period of time. He was in the army for over 40 years. There's not one soldier that's been there more than that. He was, of course, the last position he had as major general was the major general in charge of intelligence of the army. He had 3 jobs as major general before that, and underneath that, he also had 3 jobs. He was there longer than anybody. And I was speaking to him because he came to Mevaseret Zion for the Remembrance Day, for Memorial Day for the people who were fallen. And I said, are we going to have a war this summer? You know, because I figure someone like you would know. And he said to me, he said, Jeremy, on which front? So I'll leave that with you. It's not just Hamas we're looking at. You have Hezbollah. We have no idea what's happening with Syria. At any point, Jordan could crumble. We don't also know what's going to happen. Forget about Gaza. We don't know what's going to happen in Judea and Samaria. We see right now what we're witnessing is a slow collapse of the Palestinian Authority. People talk about when is it going to collapse. Based on what I see and my sources in the field, it looks like we're already witnessing a slow collapse in which local leaders are stopping to take orders from Abbas, from the national leadership in Ramallah. We could see also a breakdown of there, just like you see a breakdown from Gaza and Judea and Samaria. Judea and Samaria might both separate from each other. Within those groups, you could have separations between Tulkarm and Kalkilia and Nablus, Tubas, and Jenin. The same thing in the south with Hebron and Bethlehem. There's a lot of very, very interesting scenarios that can happen. There are a lot of threats. When you're asking me, you know, is it going to happen? I'm saying that there's a likelihood that one of those scenarios does end up playing out. I just can't tell you which one that'll be.
All right, we'll have to leave it at that. Knesset Jeremy, Jeremy Salton, KnessetJeremy.com for more amazing information in the English language about what's happening in Israeli politics. Thanks so much for filling us in on this fascinating episode on in Israeli politics. And it was quite dramatic here in Israel last week and fun as well. In any case, folks, thank you so much for being a part of of our show and trying to get the inside view and being a part of the real inside track in Israel. That's why we bring you Jeremy, because he helps us understand really what's happening on the ground. But that's all in the micro. When you zoom out and you see what's really going on, the rebuilt Jerusalem, the highway that's being built or widened out between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, you really know that we are heading towards amazing times, and the minor quakes and the bumps in the road are really part of a much bigger picture of the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. I want to hear from you, Yishai@thelandofisrael.com. I want to thank everybody out there for contributing, for being part of the show. I want to thank the good people at Capone Defense. I want to thank the good people at Hebron. Check out our website, Hebron.com, and connect to the story of the forefathers and mothers. And I want to thank you again, Jeremy, and wish you a Shabbat Shalom and a happy Lag BaOmer.
Shabbat Shalom.